Well, a question I often ask myself is, are you allowed to enjoy your job on occasion? I think the answer is yes, and I have a t-shirt on, the sun is shining, I'm sitting opposite Dr. Harry Hagopian. Yes, it's that time. It's Middle East Analysis. يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام. You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Hello, and welcome to Middle East Analysis. As I say, I'm joined by Dr. Harry Hagopian, the Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East North Africa region. Now, it's actually a day we commemorate. The 24th of April 2013 is exactly 98 years after the Armenian Genocide, and that's something we will cover later on. But the main focus of our podcast today is the rise of Islamism. And we're also going to look at political Islam and, in light of a few events that have happened recently, we will just look at the impact on the Middle East North Africa region. Harry, good to see you again. How are you doing?
I'm fine. It's been quite a funny couple of days. We started with the Boston Marathon events, and then that segued into the abduction of the two Syrian bishops in near Aleppo. So it's been quite a busy time. It's always a pleasure to come to this little niche of yours. It's almost like I'm on holiday here where I talk to you, although we seem to deal with quite substantive issues on those podcasts.
Well, when we had a little chat before this podcast and decided to take on Islam and the place of Islam, I thought, difficult subject, subject that requires some clarity, Harry. Let's look at the differences between perception, reality, the religion, the political notions, those that use Islam for their ends, and the impact on the Middle East North Africa region, crucially.
Wow, James, you've already got there a couple of hours, and I don't think our listeners, or we for that matter, have the energy or the span of attention for 2 hours. But let me pick you up on something you said already in your intro, and you repeated it now, when you talked about taking on Islam and discussing Islam. I wouldn't presume that I have any authority or any knowledge to discuss Islam as a monotheistic religion, as a revealed religion to the Prophet Muhammad. Islam is one of the three Abrahamic faiths with Judaism and Christianity, and as such, I would say that Islam is for the followers of that religion, as Christianity is for us and Judaism is for Jews. What I would say is that we need to make perhaps a little bit of a distinction, as we discussed off mic earlier, between political Islam or Islamism or Salafism or Takfirism or all those isms that have crept into our political lexicon over the last few years, certainly from 2001 onward, from the Twin Towers event in the United States and New York onward, where we've become much more clued to the realities of how religion and politics interact and interface. And this is why when people talk to me about Islamic fundamentalism as being something wrong, I say no. Fundamentalism is going to the fundamentals of a religion which Catholics, other Christians, many people of faith would actually look upon as being a positive thing. What I would say is the problem is radicalism. When you take that faith, push it toward the edges and start giving it interpretations which are far from being God-friendly and far more man-made. And it is in that sense that fundamentalism, or its Arabic equivalent, al-usuliyya, is not so much a problem for me as is radicalism and its offshoots, whether we call it in the West jihadism or any of the other isms we just talked about.
There is that distinction, though, isn't there? And it is hazy, and that's what confuses people. You have a tragedy like the Boston bombings, and instantly you hear Muslims around the world, when it's not known who has perpetrated this, saying, oh, I hope it's not in
Absolutely.
Any way associated with Islam. And lo and behold, that's what you get, admittedly, more from a Chechen angle.
Absolutely. You're spot on, James. And interestingly enough, I think from the bombing of the Twin Towers in 2001, I think the world in general, but much more so the Americans, and understandably so to a large extent, have become almost traumatized or scared of Islam. Islam did not have the same kind of impact on our collective psyche before 2001, I believe, although it has existed for 1700 years, that it did since 2001, when the bombers and the perpetrators of the horrendous massacres in New York happened to be Muslim, but with a very radical brand of Islam. And since then, I think we have always been, in the West particularly, and by the West I mean the United States or North America, but certainly Europe as well, we've been very sensitive to what could be always associated to an Islamist outrage. And this is why I think that we have to be a little bit more careful about how we talk about this. But I will flip the coin a little bit, James. And after the Boston Marathon, you know, you always joke on our podcast when you say Harry and his Twitter account. Well, Harry and his Twitter account, as we've established with our listeners, is basically a toy that he uses to dabble in with his own favorite topics. It doesn't use it professionally. But I was following the reactions, the tweets by different people, and there were huge numbers of tweets coming in from Boston and from all over the world. And the interesting thing was not only what you would expect from the West. Oh, here we go again, another Islamist outrage or Muslims committing another crime somewhere in the West, but Muslims themselves. And one tweet that moved me really was one by a Muslim woman who said, "Please God, let this not be Muslims or Arabs who perpetrated it, because we will suffer the consequences in the end." Another tweet, and I'll stop here, another tweet that I thought was wonderful, and that brings us full circle to Syria and what's happening there, was one with a picture which showed the Tansikiyat Kafar Nabil, which are basically the coordinating committees of Kafar Nabil in Syria, which were holding a poster which said, "We sympathize with the victims of Boston. Maybe Americans can now feel what we in Syria undergo every day." I thought it was not only moving, it was telling, it was poignant.
I saw that and agreed with it, but is still sort of, is that politicizing it off the back of a tragedy as well?
In some sense, it is politicizing it off the back of a tragedy, but then anything and everything in the Middle East you breathe is political. What you eat is political. Where you live is political. The accent or dialect you use is political. What you read is political. Everything is political. And that is because since Ottoman Empire times, followed by the colonial times, followed by the pseudo-independence of some of those countries in the Levant and the MENA and North Africa regions, people have been imbued with politics, and everything is political. And what has happened is that now, over politics, where it was nationalism during the times of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the president of Egypt in the 50s and 60s, it was nationalism. It was al-qawmiyya al-arabiyya, Arab nationalism, that was the essence. Then gradually things changed. There were the leftist groups, there were the intellectuals and thinkers, and now the new phenomenon that has taken over, and we see this evidence not only since the Twin Tower horrors in 2001, but certainly during the 2 year plus uprisings in the Middle East, North Africa, another layer on it, which is a layer of Islamism or political Islam, which is taking over some of those uprisings, and it is scaring a lot of people, not only Christians and smaller communities, and remember there are six or seven different communities only in Syria, let alone in other parts of the region, but it is also scaring a majority of Muslims who do not necessarily agree with this radicalized, exclusivist, man-made interpretation of what should be a divine religion.
Do you know, I don't want to push you on the definitions too much, but I find little nagging doubts with me still. When mm-hmm. we talk about political Islam and Islamism, it doesn't necessarily, although you've used the word radicalism, radicalization, it doesn't necessarily mean terrorism, though, does it, of course?
No. Political Islam or radicalism does not mean terrorism. Radicalism is when you hold an extreme interpretation or jurisprudence of a particular religion, in this case Islam. We have seen this in Christianity. Let us not forget, we in the Middle East and North Africa have been at the receiving end of the Crusades. That to me was a radicalization of Christianity, where when the crusading waves came into the Middle East, they first and foremost got rid of the local indigenous Christians who purportedly believe in the same Jesus that the Crusaders were believing in. So we have that radicalization. If you go into the Old Testament and you see some of the blood and gore that takes place there and the narrative of the Old Testament, then there is a radicalization within Judaism. Now it is within Islam. Radicalism is going to the extreme edge of interpretation. It turns into terrorism when you implement those views which you have in your head or you hold in your heart on the ground, and you victimize other people who do not believe in it. In other words, in a sentence, political Islam is using religion for political purposes.
Excellent and succinct, and I feel more comfortable with the definitions. Just quickly looking back on the Chechen situation, or the mm-hmm. brothers that have mm-hmm. obviously spent 10 years in America, I think mm-hmm. they believe, the Tsarnaev brothers. Is it a bit dangerous for us to even relate this in any way to the Middle East or North Africa? I mean, are these not individuals that were radicalized? They're not coming under any banner of a sort of cloud that can be called Al-Qaeda, a cloud of groups. I mean, should we even be looking at this?
Well, we should be looking at it in as much as they basically caused the death of two people in Boston and the injuring of so many other people. Newtown, Massachusetts was in a lockdown for a while, and I can empathize with the people who were so afraid of what was happening there. And would the second brother, the younger one who was eventually apprehended, would he actually perpetrate any more atrocities? In that sense, I understand it. I can take it one step further and say that the two kidnapped or abducted bishops in the north of Syria, the Syriac Orthodox Yohanna Brahim and the Greek Orthodox Boulos Eliazergi, they were abducted or kidnapped as they were crossing the Bab el-Hawa borderline between Turkey and the north of Syria into Aleppo. And there are rumors that the people who actually abducted them, and in so doing killed their driver, by the way, were Chechens. And they were Chechen jihadists, or people who are coming with ideas that Islam is a religion you fight for with the sword in order to create a caliphate, a world where the word of Islam is the only word that works. Now, for me, I find those people not only deluded, I don't only find them scary, I find them actually abominable, in the sense that they are so brainwashed by a version of what they believe is faith and religion, and let's remember faith and religion aren't one and the same thing, they are actually trying to force everybody to subscribe to a kind of vision that is almost nightmarish and unacceptable. This is where I have my objection. What you do in the privacy of your own room or the privacy of your own heart is one thing, but when you try and use that and perpetrate that conviction, and I use the word perpetrate advisedly, onto others and create the havoc that you do, be it in Boston, be it elsewhere in North America, in Europe, in the Middle East, North Africa, in Africa, let's not forget what's happening in Nigeria and elsewhere. All this to me is an abomination of religion and faith, and it should be discouraged because it's a small group of people. The majority of Muslims are not like that at all, nor are people of other faiths, but you have a group like that who are starved of oxygen and therefore starved of understanding the compassionate undergirding of what an Abrahamic faith is all about.
Absolutely, but let me get to the point here. Is the rise of...
You mean I was off the point?
No, no, you weren't. I'm delighted with the succinct nature of these answers, Eric. Seriously, though, is the rise of Islamism, political Islam, dangerous in the Middle East?
Yes, it is dangerous. It is dangerous in the sense that the rise of political Islam or Islamism or takfirism, which is even a more radical version of Islam, which says it's either us and our way or no other way. Everybody should basically subscribe to our understanding and tenets of what Islam dictates. And that is, to me, pardon the term, rubbish. It would be rubbish if a Christian were to tell me that. It would be rubbish if a Jew were to tell me that. It would be rubbish if a Hindu or a Sikh were to tell me that. So the same applies to a Muslim. In that sense, it is worrying because the Middle East is a mosaic of different cultures, different communities, different realities and understandings, people living together. When you bring people into the region, and it's almost an imported nature of thinking, and you ask for them to force everybody to subscribe to their own brand of understanding of religion, then you are disempowering everybody else, you're marginalizing everybody else, you're excluding everybody else, and worse, you are persecuting everybody else and threatening everybody else with all sorts of egregious consequences, not least death. That, to me, is wrong. So when I have a Syria which is overwhelmingly Sunni in nature, but you have, for instance, Christians, you have Druze, you have Kurds, you have Alawites, you have other communities as well. And all these have been living together. Syria has been really one of the models of coexistence in the MENA region. And most of the people would still like that to continue. However, when you, on the one hand, have a regime that has so much blood on its hand and has used the card of sectarianism to bring Syria to the edge as it is at the moment, only to be countered by a wave of absolutist, self-delusional religious people who would like to see the answer to one bloody regime by another kind of bloody religion, that to me spells disaster for everybody. And incidentally, since this is a Catholic voice that we are using as a way of communicating with our listeners, to all those Arab indigenous Christians who have been emigrating from the region in their droves, be it in Palestine and Israel, be it in Lebanon even, be it in Syria, in Iraq and Egypt and elsewhere.
Well, in these biblical lands, that's surely very worrying.
That is extremely worrying because some people, particularly in North America, it always amuses me when they look at me and they say, "Oh, Harry, you're a Christian. When did you convert?" "Excuse me, I didn't convert." "Oh, were you missionized?" "No, actually, I wasn't missionized. It so happens that my great-great-great forefathers were the ones who traced their lineage to the apostles and the disciples of Christ. They're the ones who contributed to the writing of the Bible. You were the ones who were converted and missionized. So let's get this into perspective." And in that sense, for a community in that whole region that has actually witnessed to its faith prayerfully but peacefully for almost 2+ millennia, to be then told that you're no longer welcome in your homeland by a very small group of extreme elements would, to me, be very, very dangerous. And it would be even more dangerous when the authorities of any of those countries collude almost with that ascendant radicalism by using it to foment more sectarianism and unease in the hope that by doing so, they prove that they're the only people who can keep control of the country, which is exactly what the likes of President Bashar al-Assad and others have done. It's either me or total chaos. You choose. I would suggest respectfully that is not the choice to be made.
I would too, but, and I don't want to say has he got a point there, because I don't really think he has on a great wad of things, but you know, you mentioned the word hope. I mean, at the start of the Arab Spring, as we talked about in our last podcast, when there was such a thing being described as such, there was optimism. There was enthusiasm. I think there was the sort of knowledge that there was going to be bloodshed and loss and there'll be pain to get to a point of greater freedom. Now, 2.5 years on, pretty much, it's a different picture, a bleaker picture. And are we now looking at people, millions of them, quite nervous that they will be replacing a dictator with something that will oppress them as well?
If we replace one poison by another, yes, we are not really achieving much. But as I said in a previous podcast, James, I believe that we have to accept that we are undergoing the labor pains of a new birth. And sometimes a new birth, and I know this from my sister-in-law, I know this from my own sister, she gave birth in 10 minutes. My sister-in-law took 4 or 5 hours of painful labor before she gave birth. Now, I'm not trying to compare my sister and sister-in-law to what's happening in the MENA region, but what I'm saying is if we look at this as the birth pangs of something that would hopefully be better, something that intellectuals, thinkers, philosophers in the region have been talking about for 3-4 decades already since the beginning of the Arab Renaissance, what I would suggest is that, one, we just cast our minds back to the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution, to the American Revolution, to the French Revolution. So much excess, so much blood was spilt, so much time, certainly not 2.5 years, until things became a bit clearer and we gradually saw a shift away from one form of autocracy into something else, which is not perfect because democracy is far, far from being a perfect tool of politics, but a better way of governance. And that, first of all, is what I would say. We need to be patient. We need to accept that there are going to be excesses. We need to accept that the Free Syrian Army is going to have blood on its hands. We just need to be sure that we don't feed into this outrage, but we try to limit it as much as we can. The second thing I would say is that the inevitability of a longer process before something more concrete, more tangible, more permeable actually evolves, we also have to accept that they are the people of the region. They have to decide which way they want to go. But I can assure you from the many, many contacts I have across the whole region that they are as worried about where they're going, be that in Egypt, be that in Libya, be that in Tunisia, be that in Yemen, be that across Syria or the whole region, even those countries that haven't been touched directly yet by those uprisings, as we are, whether today you and I sitting in this studio and discussing this, or the millions of people who are watching this, sometimes with comprehension, sometimes with incredulity.
I don't know either how long these birthing pains are going to go on, but I want to gauge whether you're an optimist or a pessimist. I mean, in whatever length of time, do you believe that the people will be well represented by the people that govern them overall in the region?
James, I don't want to be cheesy, but let me answer you in 2 very simple ways. As a man who takes his faith seriously and who believes rather than pretends to believe, and who is not a nominal Christian, at least as far as he knows, I think hope springs eternal in the heart of every Christian. So as a believer, I think, yes, there is hope, and I haven't lost hope. As a politician, as a political analyst, as a political advisor, I would be neither a pessimist nor an optimist, but I would use that very nice word that we use in the Middle East, which makes you smile already because you might guess where I'm going, a pessoptimist. Neither pessimistic nor optimistic, but hopeful.
I tell you, I'm not even going to try and repeat it. Get myself into trouble. Harry, it's time to hand over to you on a more reflective level, actually, today. It's a key day today.
It is, for me, certainly. And for humanity, for that matter.
Tell us why.
Well, because today, the 24th of April, is the symbolic day where all Armenians worldwide, 10 million of them, roughly 3 million in the Republic of Armenia, an independent post-Soviet republic, 7 million in the diaspora across the whole world, Europe, North America, Middle East, Latin America, elsewhere, we all commemorate the anniversary of the genocide of 24 April 1915, when, under Ottoman rule, 200 Armenian religious and intellectual people were arrested, imprisoned, and then killed. And that led to a whole range of massacres and pogroms that eventually culminated in the genocide in 1915, where anything between 1 and 1.5 million Armenians perished. So today is a very, very important day for two reasons. It's important because I think it is important both for Armenians and Turks to recognize this dark chapter in our history, because funnily enough, there is a lot of similarity between Armenians and Turks, but this is one very sore point in the history of Armenians and Turks, and it is good for both peoples to liberate themselves of the yoke of this chapter by recognizing it. So for 98 years, since 1915, Armenians on this day particularly remember and commemorate their genocide and their grandparents and forefathers who perished either by being killed or through the deportations from Ottoman Turkey across the Syrian desert into other parts of the world, Deir el-Zor and further afield. That is one thing. The other reason why it's important for me, because I'm not one of those radical Armenians, since we were talking about radicalism earlier on, who would say death to Turks or Turks are criminals. No. First of all, the majority of Turks either are very good and well-meaning men and women, or they don't even know the history of what happened some 100 years back. But more to the point, there were also what I call righteous Turks who helped protect Armenians during those pogroms and massacres and during the chapter of the genocide. So it's very important, first of all, to commemorate that genocide as a historical event, to think of Turks and Armenians coming together, but also not only to circumscribe our thinking to the Armenian genocide, but to think of victims of other genocides that have been perpetrated across the world. The mind immediately comes to the Holocaust. The mind comes to Cambodia. The mind comes to Rwanda. The mind comes to Darfur. All these are things that need to be done. And perhaps, again, to bring it back to where we're sitting in a Catholic studio of the Conference of Bishops, let me finish off, James, if I may, with one quotation only that I actually brought with me on a piece of paper by the new Pope Francis. When he was Cardinal Bergoglio, still in Buenos Aires in Argentina, as far back as in 2004, he said, and I quote, "We are united in grief over a genocide, the first of the 20th century, a genocide that powerful empires seek to silence and cover by all means. It is our duty and our responsibility as responsible men and women in this global world to free the world from that silence in order to be able to achieve that sense of coming together that I fight for Armenians and Turks, as well as the whole people of the world."
And if we had no other prayer today, that wouldn't be such a bad one, would it?
That wouldn't be such a bad one, and one that is sorely wanting in our world today.
Dr. Harry Hagopian, thank you very much for your time. I am going to give the name check on your Twitter account, as you mentioned it in this podcast. That's at Harry Hagopian. Catch us, Catholic Church in England, Wales, at Catholic EW. And of course, the home for Middle East analysis is catholicnews.org.uk. Harry, do join us when you've returned from your travels to the region, and we'll take on another hot topic.
Absolutely, with pleasure.